Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Well, I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Megan O'Giblin, who's a journalist who's written a number of interesting articles and that really talk about a lot of the concerns around Christianity and transhumanism and losing your faith and what it's like after that. The article in particular that I think most of us have been focusing on for the past few weeks is called My Strange Journey into Transhumanism. But that journey starts with you losing your faith. And so I'm curious, I would like to know about what was your religious background? What was that like?
So I grew up in, I would say like, I don't know. At the time, I would say I thought it was a mainstream evangelical background. I think in retrospect, maybe it was a little bit on the conservative end. Our theology was very millenarian. Our pastor frequently reminded us that we were living in the end times and that we might live to see basically the second coming of Christ. The future and sort of these narratives about the future were a big part of my upbringing. Through sort of the Christian lens. And then when I was 18, I went to Moody Bible Institute to study theology. The theology I was introduced to there was also, sort of literal interpretations of scripture in a lot of ways. We studied, I guess the most popular brand of theology there was premillennial dispensationalism. So sort of this very pessimistic view. I mean, also very focused on the future, but kind of pessimistic in that, we believed the world was just getting worse and worse, and it was going to continue like this until Christ came, and all of sort of the promises about the future in the biblical prophecies were going to take place in this other realm in heaven. I was in Moody for 2 years and then started having sort of serious doubts during the beginning of my second year there, that were mostly, I mean, it was a number of different things, but I think it could all go under sort of the umbrella of problems of cosmic justice. So sort of the classic theodicies, problem of evil, the problem of suffering. And, I really struggled to understand sort of the theology of hell and damnation, because that was something, again, we took very literally. And thinking about sort of the scope and the numbers of people that were going to be suffering in hell was something I really struggled with at the time. So that's sort of, I guess, where the article begins, is when I left Moody after that second year and was kind of on my own.
So that's interesting, because I think a lot of people have this kind of loss of faith or crisis of faith when they maybe leave a really conservative background and go to a school, right? But you went to a school that was very much part of that conservative background, right? Your crisis of faith doesn't come from an encounter with the outside world that then shakes you in a way. It seems to arise from within the kind of logic of it itself. Is that right? Or is there, am I missing?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, I think it was the case with me that I didn't totally read the Bible in depth until I went to Moody and was studying theology. You know, I think growing up, you know, you go to Sunday school, you go to youth group, and we, you know, read the Gospels a lot. I read sort of these romantic epics of Esther and Ruth, and sort of, you know, you limit yourself to these certain parts of the Bible. And, you know, going and actually, I think being a student at Moody, I was really reading a lot of parts of the Bible that I'd never read before. And so I think it was, to some extent, that immersion that started sort of those doubts for me. And it was also, you know, of course, because the framework we were in, you know, I sometimes wonder if it was sort of maybe more of a liberal theological tradition, if I would have viewed those passages differently. But some combination of, you know, being exposed to those parts of the Bible and within this sort of very narrow theological environment, I think is sort of what started the doubts for me.
Mm-hmm. So when you did leave, kind of looking ahead, when you did leave behind a Moody Bible Institute and that kind of world, was it like, what was it like to kind of enter into a more secular community?
Yeah. Well, I didn't really have a community. I think that was part of what was so unnerving about it is, you know, I lost touch with a lot of my friends from Bible school when I left, and was really just kind of very isolated and on my own for a few years. I had people I talked to at work, but, you know, it was hard because I felt like there was this whole part of my life that I couldn't explain to people, or that I couldn't sufficiently explain to them, I guess. So what it was like for me, I talk about in the essay, I think one of the most unnerving parts about leaving Christianity was just this loss of the historical narrative, this idea that history is going somewhere and that there is a future. And for me, I think that was a really... it was something I experienced really intimately, and that, you know, even to the, you know, the extent of how I subjectively experienced time throughout the day, you know, I often felt stuck just in normal tasks that I had never given any thought before. Mm-hmm. And I had trouble making decisions and keeping commitments. And, you know, I think at the time I didn't necessarily connect that with the loss of that theological narrative, but looking back, I think that that's definitely what was going on at the time.
That's really profound. It's profound that you connect, you know, your experience of faith so much to a historical narrative. I think that's very valid. But you experienced it in a really visceral way, like in your day-to-day life becoming fragmented. I've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, their experience of loss of faith, but yours is probably more, more visceral, more expressive than I've heard before. And that really kind of put some words to it for me, of what a lot of the experience, really is like to go through some kind of faith crisis, like to lose your grounding at such a fundamental level. So I wonder, like, how have you been able to, you know, outside of the kind of exploration of transhumanism and so forth, how have you been able to maybe kind of come to terms with the world in a new way?
Yeah. Honestly, I think writing has played a big role in it for me, just, you know, I think part of the issue at the time, during this period of my life that I write about, a part of the problem was that I wasn't really dealing with the problems of leaving the faith and not really taking into account how seismic those were. And so really it's just been in the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years that I've been writing about specifically this deconversion experience and writing about it from many different angles. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm hesitant to veer too much into a territory where I'm regarding my writing as a sort of self-therapy or self-help, but it really has, I feel like, you know, it's a way of sort of ordering the world for me, writing is, and it's a way of making sense of those experiences and sort of contending with what they meant. So I think that that's been a big part of it for me.
Yeah. Well, you had a, in an article you wrote on hell, you had a quote that struck me. It said, people who've gotten that far into the faith never totally shake it. To be a former believer is to perpetually return to the scene of the crime. I love that. So how do you think that that's something, like, through, you know, processing this, is that something you move away from, or is that something that's always going to be there? I mean, in your writing, you have this pervasive kind of awareness of scripture and just I would say more so than even most really diehard Christians. Like you're mm-hmm. very aware of scriptural context of religious background. Is that does that just become kind of a thing you know, or does that do you think that always remains as part of your context?
I think it will definitely always remain as part of my context. I think it's changing a little bit over time. I think a lot of my earlier essays when I first started writing about the deconversion experience were very explicitly focused on Christian and theological themes. Mm-hmm. And I think increasingly I'm maybe still referring to those ideas, but more as metaphors or as sort of more subtle themes mm-hmm. in my writing. And so, yeah, I think, I don't know, for me, I don't think I'm ever going to get away from it. I'm sort of, you know, just thinking strategically about my career. Sometimes I wonder if I should start writing about other things. And I do feel like I'm ready to start writing about other things, but it's just, it was such a huge part of my past. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because I stayed in it so long. You know, I feel like there's a good amount, you know, a few other writers out there who are writing sort of the type of essays that I'm writing who have had some sort of evangelical background or some experience in the church that they've alluded to maybe in one of their essays. For me, I don't know why it's something I keep coming back to. And I think maybe it's because I stayed a little bit longer. It seems like a lot of people have these deconversion experiences in like junior high or high school. Mm-hmm. I left Moody when I was 20 and I didn't really totally, I don't know, I didn't totally identify as an atheist or, you know, sort of leave the faith definitively till I was in my mid-20s. So mm-hmm. it's a big chunk of my life I spent thinking about these ideas, and it's definitely something I keep coming back to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, so you started school at Moody Bible like in 2001, right? So
2000, I started there, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's about like my timeline. So you've had this experience with 9/11 and with all that, and kind of seeing where the culture has adapted and adjusted over time. I'm wondering about your perspective on, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you came from a background that you perceived as being a mainstream Christian background. You know, I think a lot of people do, despite the fact that, you know, that kind of a background happens to be pretty extremely conservative. How do you view that world inside the kind of larger world now? What do you think about the interactions between those two things?
You mean sort of the role of, I guess, evangelicals in the larger culture?
Yeah, I mean, that's become a really, really contentious point, I think, you know,
yeah.
Particularly in recent times. But it seems like there's strong ideas about, what role evangelicals play. Mm-hmm. And or should play, you know. And then there's on the conservative evangelical side, there's the sense of like being under severe persecution from the outside culture.
Yeah, for sure.
And you know, I think a lot of people in a more secular context would look at themselves as being persecuted by these conservative Christians.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
how do you view those? You know, those two things now from your current vantage point?
Yeah. I don't know that I know that much about what sort of happened since I left the church, just because, I mean, I keep up on a little bit of things and my family is still very much in the church. So, but my sense, I mean, I think growing up in the church in the 90s and the early 2000s, especially, it seemed like there was this weird tension about the role that the church was supposed to play in the world and how engaged they were supposed to be in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think, and something, I guess I've written about this a little bit before, but I felt like there was this real contradiction between, on one hand, people in the church saying, you know, we don't want to be part of the world. We need to be set apart and we need to have our own values and live by our own principles. And then at the same time, this huge anxiety that the church is becoming irrelevant and we got to keep up with the culture and we got to do everything that they're doing. But, you know, and then they weren't able to do it as well, obviously. So I'm really interested in that idea. And I don't know how much that's changed since I've left the church, but it seems like that fundamental tension is still there about, you know, how relevant do we need to be? What I sense, and I don't know if this is true, but it seems like a lot of people of my generation, probably your generation, who grew up in these sort of megachurch evangelical backgrounds have sort of withdrawn from that culture into more of maybe a liturgical tradition and sort of searching for a more authentic experience that's maybe not as engaged with the contemporary world that sort of sees itself as a little more set apart. And so I'm interested in that also, but yeah, I don't know how broad that is or if this is just sort of the friends that I have and what's happened to them, but yeah.
Yeah, I think I have similar experience in terms of seeing where people's trajectories are kind of leading them, and it's an interesting question. It's interesting. A lot of people I talk to remark on the kind of paradox of the that kind of particularly pessimistic version of the evangelical world, which essentially says it's all, you know, there's basically no hope. There's nothing to work for. That is nevertheless highly invested in being influential in culture. And it's, there seems like a deep conflict there, internal conflict, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's something that you put it better than I could have, but yeah, that's something that I've noticed too. It's like, why, if the world's getting worse and worse, then why do we have a stake in it necessarily? And I think I know that it seems like with, you know, my parents' church and the church I grew up with, that they've become a little bit more optimistic in the past few years, you know, more focused on issues of social justice. And I'm not sure that that reflects a change in their theology necessarily. It might. But yeah, just that was something that we never talked about sort of social justice issues when I was growing up. And now it seems like that's sort of something that churches are trying to talk about a little bit more in the tradition that I came up in. Yeah.
So how did you go from, you know, this kind of loss of faith, kind of living in a fractured sense of life to being engaged with transhumanism and following that conversation?
Yeah, it was really just a weird coincidence. Somebody who I worked with was reading Ray Kurzweil's The Age of Spiritual Machines and lent me the book. And so I read this book, I think maybe it was a couple of years after I left Bible school. And I had never heard anything about transhumanism before. And this was, you know, like in 2006 or so. And so it was, you know, I think there wasn't that much awareness even about these emerging technologies in the culture at large. Yeah. So my first thought was that it was a work of science fiction or that it was satire or something. And then I started doing more research and found out, oh, this is this whole movement of people who are interested in these ideas and sort of are making these predictions about technology, and you know that these aren't just sort of these far out predictions. They're actually rooted in scientific premises and things like Moore's law and, you know, sort of the trajectory of how technology has been developing. So yeah, I really became, I became interested and sort of obsessed just about how a lot of the theological ideas that I've been struggling with would play out sort of in in these transhumanist premises and sort of the speculative spaces that they alluded to. And I think, you know, I write in the essay, looking back on it now, it seems like what really interested me or what attracted me to the narrative of transhumanism was that it was very similar to the theology I'd grown up with, this idea that you know, there's sort of this eschatological vision, you know, history is headed toward this point of final harmony and glorification, where everything's going to be restored. And so that to me was really attractive. I don't know if I realized that at the time, like I said, but
yeah. Well, did you, in reading Kurt's Weill, did you find it hard to believe? I mean, were you kind of, because I think a lot of people do, right? A lot of people say, you know, not likely.
Yeah.
Did you have that, that experience, or did it just kind of naturally make sense to you?
I think after I accepted that there's, okay, really smart people who believe this, you know, I like researched Kurzweil and, oh, he actually, you know, he invented the flatbed scanner and predicted the rise of the internet like 20 years before it came about. And, you know, so obviously people who know what they're talking about. And I did have I put a lot of stock in science during that period of my life, just because I think when I left Christianity, I turned instinctively to science as the sort of alternate framework to explain things. And I read a lot of physics, you know, during those years that I left Bible school. And it seemed like, you know, that side of things, physics was kind of like in a state of crisis at the time. You know, the people were talking about, you know, we don't know why gravity doesn't crush us to bits. You know, there could be multiverses. There could be all these different very surreal scenarios. And so I guess transhumanism was a version of science that seemed like, all right, at least they know what they're talking about and this is going somewhere. Mm-hmm. So that was appealing to me. And I think I did, yeah, I didn't have too much trouble believing it. Maybe I should have been more skeptical in some ways. But I think that you're right. People do have that reaction. I mentioned when I was writing this essay to my parents, you know, I sort of explained to them what transhumanism was, and they just could not, like, they're just like, no, this is, this is not a real thing. I think they were like kind of concerned about my sanity that I was writing about it. So, and I understand it. It's, you know, especially I think a lot of people, it seems really unfounded and kind of surreal.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it can definitely do that. But what I think is interesting is that, maybe like you said, your sense of historical narrative that you had grown up with, mm-hmm. where there's a rapid like discontinuity in the future, right? That's just part of the way you think about the world, mm-hmm. Makes it easier to, you know, to buy into a technological version of the same thing, right? Where I wonder if someone with less of that kind of a religious background might have a harder time with that. You know, I think of people that I know who basically just kind of assume things have to continue the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's just no question about it. And I even wonder if that's true almost. Almost like the older you get, like if you're in a religious group your entire life and you're later in life, like you've kind of maybe like acclimated a little bit. Whereas if you're, you know, kind of a younger person who grew up in this, where all this is very real and very, you know, very true and very present, things are much more, have the potential to be much more serious. I think about your questions about hell and the problem of evil and suffering and so forth. And I had those same things. And when I was a kid growing up and I was saying, okay, what about, you know, how does hell make sense in this way? You know? And, my feeling was like the adults aren't taking this seriously.
Yeah, you know? Sure. Definitely.
So I'm wondering if young, like kind of having that faith experience at a younger age and then moving over into, you know, kind of confronting these other things actually makes that plausible. You still carry with you that same kind of plausibility structure that maybe a lot of people have lost.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mentioned in the essay, you know, people who once believed are more liable to believe again in the future, in, you know, mm-hmm. in other things in the future. And I think that's the case for me, not just with transhumanism, but with just sort of any sort of philosophical framework. I'm very, I find it very easy to believe in things in sort of frameworks and ideologies, I guess. Yeah. But I also think as far as this idea about the future, and this is something I kind of hint at in the essay, but don't really talk about explicitly, but I think that us in the larger, you know, Western culture, having this legacy of Christianity in our past, I think all of us are very open to this idea of, you know, this history that's sort of going toward this final culmination. And, you know, people have made the argument even that the whole idea of scientific progress in the West owes a lot to the legacy of these Christian redemption narratives that mm-hmm. I think all of us, you know, if you compare, let's say, I mean, what people think now sort of about history and about progress, it seems to me much more optimistic than, say, sort of the Greek tragedy writers who believe, you know, we're all sort of just going in circles and we're right. at the whims of the gods. And I think that there is definitely sort of this larger idea about history and about progress that owes a lot to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people have varying amounts of skepticism toward that. But I think that that narrative in our culture is very compelling, even to people who have no background in faith or in Christianity.
Yeah.
Themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's something that Thomas Cahill in his book, The Gifts of the Jews, talks about. He attributes that whole idea of history as a narrative rather than a cycle to like the Abrahamic tradition.
Yeah.
To Abraham, sure. who leaves behind his country and does something new. So yeah, I think that's I think you're right there. There's a strong connection between those ideas, at least like emotionally and resonance wise. So walk us through that. Like, in what ways does Kurzweil's singularity mirror the biblical or the Christian kind of narrative of the future?
Well, I can talk about, I guess, I'll talk about the theological tradition that I was taught, which is not necessarily I don't know how mainstream this is, but what I was taught was that all of history is part of this redemption narrative that's been authored by God. And it goes all the way back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. You know, this idea that there is going to be this final redemption is mentioned, we were taught in the book of Genesis. And that, you know, it's a story that's been revealed sort of gradually over time, but that with each dispensation or each age, we're sort of getting closer to this final moment of the second coming, which is going to be, you know, when the dead are resurrected, the earth is going to be restored to its Edenic state, humans are going to achieve immortality, our bodies are going to be perfected and glorified. So Kurzweil's narrative, while totally naturalistic, not making any sort of appeals to divine revelation or supernatural ideas, you know, he again goes back to the beginning where he talks about, you know, sort of the first invention of tools during the Stone Age, and sort of talks about how each age has, you know, technology has progressively developed, and that it's this idea of, you know, cumulative progress, that each invention is sort of building on the other, and that this is also heading toward this final moment, which he calls the singularity, which is basically an intelligence explosion, at which point, you know, if we're connected to this technology, if our bodies are merged with it, we're going to become another species, post-human. And at that point, we'll be immortal, or some point after that, we'll be immortal. We'll be able to upload knowledge into our brains instantaneously. You know, he even talks about sort of how we can use technology to restore the earth to sort of this perfect Edenic state. And that he believes at one point we'll be able to resurrect the dead also through, you know, either digital avatars or through cryogenics or different types of technology that he mentions. So to me, there's a lot of similarities there. And I know that people have sort of made the charge against transhumanism and against Kurzweil in particular by saying, oh, it's religious, or, you know, people sort of, it's mystic, you know, it's a form of Gnosticism or Platoism, you know, all these sort of different things. But I don't know that I'd ever read sort of somebody make that comparison before. And so I think that was one of the first things that interested me about writing this piece, was just how similar those narratives are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you talk about the fact that, that many of the old theological arguments are recapitulated in transhumanist discussions. So can you talk about that for a second? Because you mentioned, like, Kurzweil talking about resurrecting the dead, and I think in your article you mentioned this argument over the resurrection of the body.
Yeah, so that was a big, this is something that I just discovered during the research process and that I found so fascinating. This idea that, you know, if you go back and read a lot of the early treatises on the resurrection that were written in, you know, between the first and the third century, one of the big questions and one of the big debates that was happening was, is the resurrection going to be physical? Is the whole body going to be resurrected, or is it just going to be spiritual? And sort of the Hellenistic view and the Gnostic view is that only the spirit survives, and that the spirit's going to go on to have this afterlife, but the body remains in the grave. And sort of the Orthodox Christian view that won out after a lot of these debates was that the whole body had to be resurrected for it to be a true resurrection. And so part of this had to do with the idea that Christ was resurrected in his full body, the same body that had been crucified, that he had, you know, the nails, scars in his hands and the scars on his side. And so that's sort of the idea that won out. And which is interesting to me, because that's actually, you know, an idea of sort of the soul-body relationship that's more contemporary and based on contemporary science, that we're a psychosomatic unit, you know, that we're not, you know, every part of your body, including your gut bacteria, contributes to who you are as a person. So sort of these, a lot of similar debates are happening in transhumanism now, because there's sort of a faction of people who say we're going to have to leave our bodies behind. We're just going to have to upload our minds into supercomputers, and some form of our consciousness will survive, but our bodies are going to die. And then there's sort of another faction that believes that the whole body can be resurrected, you know, and these people are sort of more into cryogenics or, you know, computer implants, or sort of these different ways of keeping the body or part of the body and resurrecting it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting. And
I do too. I think that's fascinating. And I totally agree. I do think it's interesting, like you said, that the that kind of idea that's tied up with the resurrection of the body seems to be a more kind of current, you know, it's more applicable to our modern world in a way than maybe even some of the ideas that were less orthodox but are more common or more kind of widespread in kind of casual Christian conversation.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That was something also that, you know, wasn't totally clear to me in my theology as a young person. I think at Moody, we talked more about it, but, you know, I never thought about, oh, that it's my actual body that's going to be resurrected. And I think it is because there's a lot of popular culture and just sort of the more casual Christian understanding that your spirit leaves your body and that's what goes on to heaven. But if you read, you know, the scriptures, it talks about how it's, you know, that no, the bodies are going to be what's resurrected, and that the body survives into eternity, which is, yeah. Yeah. I think there is, yeah, probably still a lot of misunderstanding about that, even in the church.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my, impression growing up in, you know, that people pretty much had the idea that it's just our spirits, you know, that's the idea. And on reading some of, you know, the more orthodox writers, people who are more connected to kind of historic Christianity, and realizing the significance that they placed on the body, because it connected with everything else, right? Mm-hmm. For us to talk about the resurrection of the body is also to talk about the importance of the physical world And so in this paradoxical way, I find that like that kind of thinking is so much more pertinent to concerns that we face now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it seems to have, there seems to be a resurgence of interest in that kind of conversation. I'm not sure what's driving that, but that's an interesting thing that seems to be happening.
Yeah, definitely.
So you talked about some other kind of religious thinkers along the way. You talked about Dante, Teilhard de Chardin, and some of these. And so where do you see them playing into this kind of trajectory of transhumanism? Obviously, there's like this kind of transhumanist backstory almost.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think their significance actually is?
Yeah, this is also something I didn't really know much about until I started researching this piece. I guess the point I started from was that, okay, there's all these similarities between transhumanism and Christianity. Transhumanism happened to evolve out of a culture in the West that is very steeped in Christianity. Is what's the link, you know? Mm-hmm. So I went back to looking at, I started talking about medieval alchemists, which were basically the first Western scientists. And I mentioned one in particular in the piece, Roger Bacon, who was a 13th century friar who was trying to concoct basically an elixir of life that would help make the body immortal and uncorrupted. And he was very inspired by Paul's epistles and sort of the description of the resurrected body in those epistles. And again, that was just one example, but from the research I did, he's very representative of this idea that, you know, some of the earliest practitioners of modern science, basically alchemists, were working within these monastic communities and, you know, Benedictine and Franciscan monks. And they had very millenarian theology also, you know, they were very inspired by the biblical prophecies. And so they saw science as really connected to that project and this idea that they could achieve immortality or to sort of maybe expedite the second coming of Christ through alchemy and through science. Mm-hmm. And then I also talk a little bit about Nikolai Fyodorov, who is a Russian ascetic and philosopher. I guess he was really sort of an obscure figure in the 19th century, who's a librarian in Moscow. And he developed a small cohort of followers, including Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, who were both interested in his ideas, which is interesting. But he basically believed that all of humanity should focus their efforts on what he called the common task, which was resurrecting the dead, everyone who had ever died. But that this wasn't something that was going to happen supernaturally, that God wasn't going to bring it about, that God actually wanted us to work toward this project, and that he believed it could be brought about through specifically science and technology. Mm-hmm. So I talk about him, and he was actually ended up being sort of the inspiration for this larger movement called Russian Cosmism, which was a huge part of, you know, the development of the Soviet space program and all of these sort of later. So it was really, I think a lot of his ideas were very ahead of his time. And then I do talk about moving into the early 20th century, Teilhard de Chardin, who is a French Jesuit priest and paleontologist who, he also believed he had sort of this, I don't know how to explain it except like sort of a theological view of evolution, this idea that God was directing evolution, mm-hmm. and that he was slowly bringing us closer to, through evolution and through technology, to sort of these final prophecies. And he proposed an idea called the Omega Point, which was an intelligence explosion and very clearly a precursor to Kurzweil's singularity. The same idea that all of the machines in the future were going to be connected is what he predicted, and that the human minds would and human consciousness would become more connected. And that through this connection, we were going to have this intelligence explosion, and that we would basically break through the framework of time and space and merge with the divine. So this is how we thought the resurrection was going to take place. And I think that his ideas, reading about them, that is really where you see a very clear link between someone like Ray Kurzweil and his ideas and sort of these earlier Burmistic ideas. And there is a link. I talk about one of Teilhard's, I guess one of his biggest fans was Julian Huxley, who is a British biologist and eugenicist. And he was very inspired by these ideas about the future, but he believed that they didn't need to be connected to any sort of religious narrative. He thought, you know, this is what humans should try to do without God, without any sort of, I guess, spiritual telos. And he, I think, was one of the first people in the 20th century to use the term transhumanism explicitly mm-hmm. in one of his lectures. He said this idea should be called not humanism, but transhumanism, because it's about us overcoming our limitations as humans. So from there, I think, yeah, there's a very, very clear link to contemporary transhumanism.
So that's interesting. So you would see it as, you know, he was carrying forward Teilhard's kind of vision and viewpoint, but specifically trying to remove the religious component,
mm-hmm.
specifically trying to extract that. That's interesting. I don't know what kind of information there is about this, but in terms of, you know, people like Bacon and Fedorov, who are proposing technology as playing a very significant role in the vision of God, right? How do you think other religious people at the time were responding to that or would react to that?
During Teilhard's time, I haven't done a lot of research about this, but my sense is that these thinkers were very ahead of their time, and that that there probably wasn't a huge following for them at the time, and that I think, yeah, you might be right that there was sort of, especially with Fyodorov. What's interesting is that there's actually Dostoevsky sent Fyodorov a letter at the time, and he seemed very sympathetic to this idea that the resurrection could come about through technology, but he was also very baffled by it. And it's a great, I wish I had it with me, but the letter, you know, he's just sort of, let me get this straight. So you think that all the things that are predicted in the Bible, that this is going to happen technologically. So you can sort of sense that sort of the disconnect a little bit, but also the interest that was there. And I mean, that's just one example, but you know, Fyodorov said himself that he believed that his ideas weren't going to be accepted until much later. In fact, he even used this metaphor of resurrection, where he said they're going to have to be buried for a long time before they're resurrected in the future. And to me, I sort of got goosebumps when I read that, because it's like, well, that's sort of, in a way, what's happening with transhumanism. But yeah, I think that, you know, all of the thinkers that I talk about, maybe with the exception of the alchemists, because they were in specific religious communities, but that these were sort of people that were maybe far ahead of where the church was at the time in which they lived.
Yeah. Yeah. So the, speaking of being far ahead of where the church is, but when you talk about this kind of connection, or when you bring up this kind of connection with secular transhumanist audiences, what is the reaction that you see there?
Yeah, I'm curious about what their reaction is, I guess. And I haven't heard a lot. It seems like there's a lot of tech people who have just sent me emails or posted about the article on Twitter. And it seems like they're mostly sympathetic toward it. I did get an email from Ray Kurzweil after the Guardian piece came up. And he seemed like he was sort of sympathetic in some ways to the argument too, which is something that was a little bit surprising to me, because I felt like I didn't know how sort of the secular transhumanist community would regard, you know, these, you know, having their philosophy connected to Christianity. Just because you know, there, I think there is at least a strain that I would say sort of the mainstream of transhumanism seems very much to want to distance themselves from religious ideas and to say, no, we're, you know, carrying on this legacy of the Enlightenment and everything is sort of about rational purposefulness. And, you know, I think for obvious reasons, they probably don't want to connect their philosophy or their movement to ideas that they might see as mystic or superstitious in any way. But I think there's also a lot of variation. You know, I think Kurzweil, he does evoke religious metaphors often in his writing. And so I think he might be one of the people, I think, who is maybe sort of more open to those connections, or that, you know, is more sort of explicit about drawing sort of a lineage there.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that, you know, in my interactions with people, there are people who welcome Christian transhumanists. There are people who welcome the connection with Christianity, and there are people who are really antithetical to, or like, you know, adamant that must be rejected and you know, be kind of driven out, right? Because that poses some kind of existential danger or risk. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's Zoltan Istvan, who wrote a transhumanist novel, the Transhumanist Wager. He poses this dilemma, or the main antagonist of his storyline is religious people, right? There's the transhumanist hero, and then there's the more or less religious antichrist kind of, and they're kind of in a battle to over the future of the world. What do you think that comes from? Why would it be that transhumanism would, like, the secular transhumanist might see religion as the enemy? Yeah,
I think it definitely comes from evangelicals. I think we're
our fault.
Yeah, no, I mean it's interesting too, because it seems like, well, I mentioned in the article too that there is this tradition of sort of the religious right being opposed to things like stem cell research or genetic modifications to the body, and this sort of aversion to the idea of playing God. Mm-hmm. And so I think because there is that factor of, I should say it's a faction of evangelicalism, not evangelicals at large, but because there's this very vocal faction that has spoken up politically against these past sort of scientific debates, I think that's my sense, is that where sort of that animosity comes, that these are going to be the people, once it comes up to, you know, if these things make it into the political realm where we have to vote on, you know, whether we're going to do these things or allow them, that those might be the people who take issue with it. My sense, it seems like among, and you probably know more about this than I do, but it seems like the people who are interested in the, like within Christianity, people who are writing about transhumanism and maybe more open to it tend to be a little bit more maybe like Orthodox or from liberal traditions, theological traditions. And it seems like sort of the more conservative evangelical tradition that I was raised in tends to be very reactionary and is sort of looking for the next thing of, all right, what are we opposed to? And what, you know, what do we have to watch out for? What's going to threaten our worldview? And I think I'm just personally really interested to see how that's going to play out as these, because I do think that a lot of these emerging technologies are going to make it into more public conversations and into the public realm in the future. And so I'm really eager to see how the church is going to react to that. And if there are going to be, it seems like a lot of factions and divisions that take place because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. There's the, like you said, the reactionary standpoint. And then there's the more, mainline. I don't know that those are clean divisions, but,
You're absolutely right.
But that's, that is interesting. It does seem that the reactionary standpoint, of course, is the one that takes some of these ideas the most seriously, that really believes. And you know, I have people discussing, you know, discussing with me who really think that these things are both real and are basically the Antichrist. Like, they look like Christianity, but they're the counterfeit version or something like that. And so that's really interesting. It's interesting how far you could push that, you know, because Jesus runs up against the same thing, right? The Pharisees say, oh, you're casting out demons by the power of Beelzebub, you know? And, so there's that tension. Maybe it always comes up, right? Like, you're doing something good, but are you doing it, you know, in the right way or for the right reasons or something like that? So that's an interesting, phenomena. And yeah, I think maybe you're right. That means we're going to look at a lot of different factions of how these things are handled. That's probably going to be unfortunate, because that's going to be a tough one to resolve. So do you have any insight into how we should resolve those debates as a society?
No, I'm just as a larger society. Yeah, I don't know. I would hope that, you know, as these technologies become more of a potential reality, that there is more public debate about it, both inside the church and out of it. You know, I'm always surprised by, I mean, I've been following these ideas now for, I guess, over 10 years. And so when I tell people what I'm writing about, there's a lot of people, even young people, who have no idea what transhumanism is, or maybe are just sort of vaguely familiar with it. And I think that maybe that's changing a little bit, but it's still, you know, if you look at sort of the technologies that are being, you know, developed at Google or, you know, Tesla or wherever, I think that there's not a lot of public awareness about those technologies or the ethical debates that are happening around them. Yeah. It seems like it's happening mostly in these very isolated environments and think tanks and among people who are in Silicon Valley. And, you know, there's not a whole lot of talk about it in the broader public sphere. And I think that that could potentially be a problem, because I think that there should be more public debate about them, and that these are really, really difficult decisions that we're going to have to be making in the next, you know, several years and several decades. And that, yeah, it would be nice if people were talking about them a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So let's jump into the craziest stream of transhumanist thought, which is simulation theory. Mm-hmm. So talk about that. Talk about how you encountered that and what your impression of it was.
Mm-hmm. So simulation theory, I'm not sure if this was the first version that's ever been proposed, but the version that I was exposed to was Nick Bostrom's article, which is titled, "Are You Living in a Computer Simulation?" Mm-hmm. Bostrom's a Oxford philosopher, a very smart guy. He identifies as a transhumanist. And he basically invented this thought experiment that argued that we could very possibly be living in a computer matrix-like computer simulation of the past created by our post-human descendants. So this idea that, you know, we already have sort of games like The Sims that are sort of these simulated environments, and that if we continue developing technology, those are going to become more sophisticated, and that the people who are living in them are eventually going to gain something like consciousness. And so it's likely in the future that one of the purposes of these simulations, you know, either for sort of educational or entertainment value, is going to be to recreate versions of the past. So just as we go to historic simulated villages today to sort of see how people in, you know, the 19th century lived, you know, that these our descendants were going to be sort of using these computer simulations to see how we lived, and that if there's going to be more of these simulations, that many, many more in the future, then there our baseline reality, it's more likely than not that we're in a computer simulation today than we are in sort of the original 2017. So it's kind of a wild idea. And Bostrom admitted in the paper that it was very tongue-in-cheek. It was sort of a thought experiment. But people have taken it very seriously, including, I think, Elon Musk last year said that the chances were one in a billion that we're not currently living in a simulation. So, and there's been this whole, so I came across this article, I think I just found it online after being on transhumanist message boards and, you know, sort of nosing around the internet. What interested me about it was the way that sort of the theodicies that I've been struggling with at Bible school, how those would change or just maybe be complicated in a way by this idea that of a simulated cosmology, you know? So a lot of the problems I've been sort of mulling over at Bible school, like the problem of evil or the problem of suffering, rely on this idea of God as, you know, being benevolent, omnipotent, and omniscient. And I think also was sort of implicit in those arguments are this idea that God is in total control over his creation, the way that, you know, I think the argument from design that I grew up with was sort of this watchmaker's argument that, you know, the designer has to be more complicated and in total control of his creation. And I think that when you start getting into, you know, technologies like computer simulations and sort of digital technology, it gets really complicated. You know, and what if our creator is just a programmer? He's not necessarily God, he or she, and, you know, that they don't have these sort of divine qualities. What does that say about divine, like cosmic justice? What does that say about the world we live in? And what does it also say about, you know, how much control they have? I say in the piece, you know, computers get bugs sometimes that even elude, you know, their creators. So what if evil is, you know, one of those bugs? So I think there's a lot of really interesting sort of implications of simulation theory. And I'm also at this point interested in it as a thought experiment. But there was a point, I think, when I first read about it where I was really considering these as, you know, what if the whole Genesis narrative is basically just about the creation of the simulation? And, you know, there's a really, I think, you know, tempting way in which you can read the whole biblical narrative through sort of that technological lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we've seen the growth in recent years of open theism, which is basically a theology which says, you know, which does read the scripture and says, the scriptural portrayal of God is not of the kind of all controlling God, you know, who controls every aspect, but who is engaged in this kind of maybe tug of war with, you know, with various aspects of creation. And so is kind of dealing with bugs in the system and so forth. So, it's interesting. We've seen that, and that kind of, you know, as an answer to the problem of evil, and that kind of correlates with what you're describing there inside the simulation theology or whatever.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah.
You talked about being on, I think, some simulation theology message boards, and I thought, oh man, I missed those somehow. That sounds like a place I needed to be. So what was that like? Who was having this kind of conversation? Other than you.
Yeah. So there is this whole weird corner of the internet that I stumbled on, and it's still out there. I've gone back and reread some of the articles, but people who are basically fans of Bostrom's simulation theory, they've come up with simulation theology articles about like how you should live if you're in a simulation. Mm-hmm. So sort of what are the implications of this? And you know, people, I think a lot of it is, some of it sort of seems tongue in cheek in the spirit of Bostrom's argument, but some people get very serious about it also. And these are people who are, you know, either software engineers or philosophers, or I think there's a couple of theologians that wrote about these ideas too. But I think a popular strain of simulation theology, if there is one, is probably this very sort of Nietzschean will to power. You know, like you should just try to make yourself as visible as possible, as make your life a work of art. Because if the programmers are interested in keep holding onto your software and resurrecting it or recycling it, you know, you want to get their attention. So try to become a celebrity, try to become friends with celebrities. You know, so there's a lot of different ideas. And I don't think that, you know, it's a limited pool of articles. So obviously people haven't exhausted all of the different implications of that. Yeah. But yeah, I was really interested that there were people who were automatically, you know, thinking about this in theological terms.
Well, have you run across the new God argument by any chance?
No.
Okay. So it's a explicitly religious and theistic version of the simulation, argument. And it basically just generalizes the simulation argument to any kind of creative process. Argues that, basically our estimate of our own future potential should be correlated with our estimate of the probability that we're in a created world. And has some additional arguments for the idea that that these creators would be benevolent and so forth. So that's you know, carrying that forward, you should look into it. You'd enjoy it.
I definitely would. Yeah. sounds super interesting.
But that's, you know, I think what's interesting is that, like, that simulation theology that you're talking about, that kind of comes away with a morality that is very Nietzschean. You know, that I think you can see a similar back and forth within religions and within, you know, within history too, like where people are like, okay, here's our values. And then over time they think about those values and they're like, okay, well, that doesn't hold up as well. You know, we need more subtle kind of communal values. And I wonder if we'll see that same kind of trajectory in within like a simulation theology, if after thinking about it a while, you're like, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe there are other things that need to play into this, and it becomes a much more, like, again, recapitulating a sort of, you know, moral evolution or whatever, as we've seen in our religious histories. I don't know. That's intriguing. So there we have a full kind of gamut of parallels between Christian thinking and like the transhumanist thing, and the thing that, you know, you would think, okay, it can do everything in Christianity except provide us a God, but here it's done that job too.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know what to make of that. What's your overall take on that whole process?
Of sort of the emergence of a God within transhumanism. Yeah. Oh, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think something, I don't know what I want to say about this. What's interesting to me is that these arguments, these sort of new technological arguments for design, which is essentially what simulation theory is that it is arising at this point where, as I mentioned, you know, physics is sort of at this impasse, and we really are starting to believe that maybe we're not ever going to understand what's going on in the universe, or that, I guess, maybe that the universe is a little bit more opaque than we thought it was. And that, you know, you even have, I think, you know, there's been some sort of discoveries in physics too that seem to even support this idea of a simulated cosmology, where you have, you know, in quantum mechanics, you have sort of like these NASA scientists that are saying, actually, the way that our world works is very similar to a video game, where, you know, particles only sort of appear when they're observed. And so there's, I think that maybe one of the reasons why people find those arguments compelling are because it does sort of reflect maybe the breakdown of these sort of older ideas of the universe as being something that is within our understanding. And so maybe it makes more sense to believe that there is some sort of creator or some sort of divine, I don't know, some sort of consciousness, I guess, mm-hmm. behind it. And I find it really compelling myself. I think even, you know, when I left the faith, I've always had a hard time believing that we're an accident, that we're just a cosmic accident. And, you know, and I don't know if that's just the limitations of my human mind. You know, I don't know that I would make the argument explicitly that, oh, well, we have to, you know, there has to be a God or there has to be a designer, but it's just one of those things that just instinctively at a gut level makes sense to me that there is some sort of order or some sort of consciousness in the universe. And I think that, you know, as we start developing these technologies that, you know, we are sort of becoming godlike in a sense over these, you know, either through AI or through computer simulations, I think it's becoming, again, sort of easy for us to conceive of how there might be something larger out there that we're part of. Yeah.
So in your article, you kind of talk about that as like almost a dangerous hope, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is something that draws you, that kind of drew you into transhumanism and then into kind of thinking about transhumanism in these religious ways. But you seem to see it as like a danger to, like almost like an addiction to kind of step away from in some sense. Like talk about that. What's the danger? Do you think it's a danger in general? Is it just a danger for recovering fundamentalists, or what's the real issue there?
Yeah, I think that when I, you know, there is that sort of note of skepticism or danger, I think, especially toward the end of the piece. And for me, that's mostly a personal issue, I guess, where I do feel like, you know, I spent so much of my life believing in this idea that I ended up leaving, and I know that I'm susceptible to other similar ideologies. And so I think I'm tend to be very skeptical of sort of getting pulled back in to those things that seem like maybe they're rooted in, I don't know, wishful thinking, or that seem sort of maybe very conveniently to reflect things that I want to be true. At the larger level though, like, I don't know. And I think that maybe the essay is a little bit more ambiguous about sort of what role that, or sort of maybe the possible benefit of that hope in the larger culture. You know, like we do have, you know, this idea that there is some sort of telos to technology and to science, and that history is going somewhere, whether you attach a religious perspective to that or not. I think that's sort of something that's implicit in our Western worldview. And I think that I'm very ambivalent about that, or maybe I'm undecided about sort of the benefits of that. I think that, you know, if you look back on sort of this more optimistic strain in Christian history, you know, people who believe that the millennial kingdom or the kingdom of God was something that we could achieve on earth, I think there's ways in which that's been used in a very positive way, you know, like the social gospel movement, which was very concerned about social justice in sort of the 19th, early 20th century. You know, that there are sort of these good human projects that can come out of that hope. But then I think that there's also probably downsides to that too. You know, I think the early European settlers were very, had very millenarian theology, and were very focused on sort of America as this embodiment, or the new world is sort of this is where the kingdom of God is going to happen, and sort of inspired this more dangerous idea of manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, yeah, it depends on how you use it. You know, it depends on that the hope can be, I don't think it's necessarily a positive or negative thing. Just the same way that technology is not necessarily positive or negative. It can have, you know, it depends on how you use it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's a good question, though.
No, I like it. That's I think you're exactly right. I think maybe our there's a certain kind of stream of our culture that has gotten very, very wary of too much hope. And, you know, seeing the world wars and then the Cold War and, you know, all that seemingly, you know, seemingly built on these really hopeful ideas, right? Like the conflicts of the 20th century were in a large part built on really big hopeful ideas about what humanity could become. And we've seen that go wrong enough that we're scared of it, right? But it does both of those things, I think. It does, you know, it can create dangerous and disastrous things and also wonderful things. And I think of Martin Luther King, and I don't know what his actual eschatology was, but the way he spoke evoked an eschatology that was, you know, he was very much like speaking in the tradition of the kind of Jewish prophets about, you know, this apocalyptic thing that was necessary, that was pushing its way into the world, and that was going to make, you know, make a world that was more just and more equitable. So I think we see it. It's on both sides of those, of that equation. And yeah, it's, I agree. It's, it can produce great, great good and great evil, just like technology can.
Yeah, definitely.
So where does that leave you now? Like, so you've kind of realized like where transhumanism was kind of serving this role for you and so forth, reflected on that. What does that leave you thinking about in terms of your own relationship to transhumanism and your relationship to religion? Like, would you still identify as a transhumanist? Are you skeptical, or just what's your situation in regards to those things at this point?
Yeah, no, I don't think I'd identify as a transhumanist. I'm sort of like maybe a very obsessive spectator of the movement. And I think that's probably true from the beginning. I mean, I think I maybe bought in more literally to a lot of the concepts, you know, when I first encountered them. And I think I'm skeptical of them, but I'm not, I think I'm just, my fascination sometimes outweighs my skepticism. I think I went into this article thinking, oh, I'm going to expose transhumanism for, you know, it's just another version of Christianity. It's sort of ersatz Christianity. And I think once I started doing the research and realizing like, oh, this is actually this much longer theological tradition, and that this idea of, you know, humans sort of bringing about these biblical prophecies through science and technology, this is something that's been happening through generations. To me, that was just really interesting and sort of sad in a way too, that, you know, we keep having this hope and we haven't gotten there yet, at least. And so I think maybe in some ways it made me more sympathetic toward transhumanism and toward sort of that impulse toward, you know, what they're working toward. You know, Christianity, I'm always having sort of ambivalent feelings about it. I think I'm in a community now that is very secular, you know, people who have a lot of postgraduate degrees and that sort of didn't grow up in Christian homes. And I tend to get very defensive about, you know, sort of these implicit biases toward Christians. So I find myself in a place of defense often about sort of the value of religion, I think, which I think it is really valuable to people's lives. And I think that there's a lot of misunderstandings about religion and about Christianity in particular in the wider culture. But where does that leave me? I don't know. I'm mostly just interested in sort of the intersections of these ideas and just really curious to see where it's going to go in the future. Yeah.
Well, I think it's great, and I think you should keep exploring those intersections, because I think they are incredibly fascinating and also incredibly significant, and in a way that it seems like few people are realizing. So I'm going to, I'll put links to your article, both the Journey into Transhumanism and the Hell one, because I thought that was great as well. What else should people, anything else that people should look at to follow your work or anything like that?
I should mention that there's a longer version of the transhumanism piece. And that was actually who I wrote it for, M plus One magazine out of New York. And then it got picked up also by The Guardian. The Guardian version is a little bit shorter, but I think sort of most of the basic ideas are there as well. But if you want to, if you want the full long read, M plus One, and I believe it's still online, available online through their website. So, yeah.
Good. Yeah. Good deal. That's the one I read, first. And like I said, I loved it. I thought it was beautiful and haunting. And, so thanks for doing that. And, thanks definitely for talking with me, and I hope that we can talk again in the future. Love to see more of your work as you go forward.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.